We sit glued to the TV set all night
and every night.
Why go into the outside world at all?
It's such a fright.
We got nothing better to do than watch TV and have a
welcome to the TV Times 3 podcast. We're doing episode 26. I'm Jason the TVaholic from TVaholic.com.
I'm Emery from MyTakeOnTV.com.
And I am Miles McNutt from Cultural Learnings.
And we've got a guest with us in place of Ray, who's still on vacation.
Yes, the longest vacation ever, though she did she did find time to podcast with me. Sweet.
Although at some point, I'm hoping you will have heard Amory and Ray talk about Paley before you listen to this one.
Which I promise we recorded it, so hopefully it'll go up before.
It exists.
It does.
And so with us, we have Miles from, as you said, from Cultural Learnings. And could you talk a little bit about what you do at the blog?
I love talking about what I do. for the most part, I'm kind of I call myself a fake TV critic, and that's kind of what I'm doing. It's a job that's not really a job. I write a lot of reviews. I Twitter a lot at twitter.com/MEMLES. And I've even been doing
some podcasts. Let me interrupt you. How do you pronounce that?
Okay.
Because we go back and forth on this. I think the three of us say it three different ways. So I want to see how you actually say it.
There's some issues of contention around this subject. My blog address is MEMLES. It is a nickname from my childhood, and I have always pronounced it Memels, which makes no sense.
Okay.
Versus any. However, for the most part, I let people say Memles because it actually is how it looks. So you're allowed to say it however you'd like. Personalized.
I always say Memels, so that's a whole third pronunciation.
There's just a combination of the third of the two. That's
really right down the middle. But no, and then I've been doing some podcasting with McNuttcast with my brother, just kind of talking about pop culture and doing all those things. All of it an outlet for my constant insanity when it comes to TV, movies, everything else. So I am happy to be here to continue spreading my web.
Excellent. Welcome you.
Yes, and I'm, as I said, I'm very glad to be here. I love the show, love following you guys on Twitter. Great fun.
Excellent.
Sweet.
I was telling the story, and if people have listened to our PaleoFest podcast by this point, they will know the story of Miles leaning over my shoulder and saying, "Oh, hey, I think I know you at PaleoFest," because he could see my take on TV on my phone. And my favorite story that I've been telling from Paley is that he's like, "Well, how are your flights?" And your reaction was brilliant when you were like, "It's a little awkward because I kind of know because I've been following you on Twitter." I'm like, "See, Twitter, bringing everybody together."
Yes, that is about that. Well, I felt really awkward because I realized that I was sitting behind you. And I'm like, I could just sit here for this entire panel and not say anything. But I'm like, you were literally like 2.5 feet in front of me. And that would be really weird after the fact.
Yeah, this is true. Oh, by the way, Emery, I was sitting right behind you. Yeah. That'd be weird.
It could always be one of those where you're on Twitter, you're like, at my take on TV, are you sitting right in front of me at Paley? Is that you? On Twitter.
I totally would have loved to have done that if my Canadian phone would have actually worked in LA, but unfortunately it didn't. So the stalking opportunity was limited. I apologize.
Nice. Okay, so what news do we have?
The first thing I've got listed on the news items is NBC has pulled Kings from Saturdays and I guess is supposed to play it on Saturdays starting in June. So
I'm super bummed about this.
Yeah.
Because it had a lot of potential.
It really did. Like, I really enjoyed. I think I only watched the first 4 or 5 episodes. I think I'm one episode behind the one that actually aired on Saturday. But
yeah, I haven't watched
for the most
yet.
Part. It was a really engaging show and it was reaching so high. It's kind of like, for its demise, like, we all predicted it in a way. Like,
yeah,
everyone
exactly.
said it was going to fail. We said it was going to happen. But at the same time, no one wanted to see it go out this way. It's a little bit embarrassing.
I don't know why they don't just leave stuff on Saturdays and stuff like that. I guess, obviously, still Law & Order repeats still pull in a greater rating than even this, you know, in repeats. But
just one of the things like they're actually doing is they have Southland repeating on Saturdays now. And I guess they consider that as an ability for them to build a show that has a potential future as opposed to a show that they know doesn't.
Yeah, but they still could have done King's Southland now they're doing Law and Order Repeat, Southland, Law and Order Repeat, you know, or one of the one version of the Law and Order. And so they could have had a new show leading into a repeat of while they're still playing it out. As long as they do bring it back at least and play it over the summer so that they at least finish out the episodes that they have, I'll be all right with that. But I hate when they pull it, it's off for a couple of weeks, they put it on Saturday, it 1 week for people to realize that it's been moved to Saturday, and then they pull it off, and then people are like, what happened to it? You know, where'd it go?
Yeah. Well, to be fair, it was like the three of us watching it, so we all knew that it was moving.
Well, I think that's the thing, looking at any show in that situation, is like, for me, I really do hope they air it on TV, because otherwise I won't get to see it, because even if they put it on Hulu, as a Canadian, I'm screwed. So I'm really hoping that they do. That's going to be a recurring theme of this podcast, I'm sure, but I'm really curious to what degree that they really do kind of put it on the air, because let's face it, there's nothing else going to be on Saturdays, you know, in June. Like, that's going to be a dead zone anyway. It's a dead zone now, so, and I guess I can understand why they wouldn't want it, the, how low Kings is going to be a May sweeps issue. Like, to have to say one of their shows is drawing that little ratings is never going to be a good sign. But at the same time, when you know it's dead, give it a chance to kind of burn out. And if they knew this was going to happen, I wish they would have just not bothered putting it on Saturdays, just said they were going to air it during the summer and called it a day. Like, there's some better ways they could have done this, but let's face it, NBC's a mess right now.
Yeah, they totally don't know what to do.
There's actually going to be some good TV on Saturdays over the summer with Kings and then Pushing Daisies and then Eli Stone and stuff over the summer. So, Dirty Sexy Money. So, yes, Saturdays are going to be hot for scripted television over the summer on the networks.
That's going to be weird.
It is going to be weird.
All right. The next item I had is just to mention that Showtime has picked up The Tudors for a fourth and what will be the final season.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I don't know how they could go past four seasons because he's on his fourth wife by the end of this season. Spoiler alert, like, for those of you who don't know about him, I say that all the time. Whenever I talk about The Tudors, I'm like, spoiler alert, he had six wives, like, whatever. Joss Stone is playing Anne of Cleves, and Anne of Cleves is his fourth wife, which means he only has two more wives to get through, so.
This just shows trajectory, even, like, I'm glad that they're not trying to kind of draw this out. Like, Showtime
is like, data fake history or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean, like, as it is, yes, it's historical fiction. It's always going to be historical fiction. But I think that they're smart. They've always said two wives a season. That's kind of how they've always wanted to do it. They are now at a point where they've got a good pace going. So when I eventually do get to this series in any great detail, which is on my list eventually, I'm looking forward to the fact that they actually do kind of have an end point, that they have a fourth and final season to try to resolve things.
Exactly.
Awesome. Not that we don't know the resolution, but...
Well, it's always, you know, for those that didn't really pay attention in history or anything, you can always pick up a few details here and there. The next thing I have listed is Lifetime has set the return for Army Wives for June 7th, but also the first version of Project Runway on Lifetime will start up August 20th.
I'm very interested in how that will play out.
Yeah, but it's just so far away. Like, I mean, like, admittedly, you know, I'm a bit nuts for Project Runway. I think it's great. I think it's incredibly compelling. I find it involves a lot more skill than a lot more reality shows, so I really enjoy it. So August 20th seems really late, and it's just kind of like, how much of the wind will be out of the show's sails when it went through the whole legal battle?
Especially since Bravo has their own design show now with Isaac Mizrahi and Kelly Rowland. Now, I know, like, it's not Project Runway, and Tim Gunn makes Project Runway or whatever, but still.
Yeah, exactly. It's one more kind of piece of competition that Bravo can say, look, we can do this show too. And as somebody who is not, like, so, like, blindly loyal to Project Runway, like, I want to see, you know, really catty people make fashion. And that's totally cool. And if Bravo's show offers that, I'll watch it too. And that's kind of and perhaps, you know, that might even help Project Runway, that's there to kind of fill a gap, remind people about it. And then when Lifetime comes out with their own, it's like, oh, look, here this is again. Clearly they're not too tired of it. The ratings kind of keep going up. But, I mean, like, there's actually Project Runway Canada just finished up here. And so for me, I mean, I had my fix, if you will. But I'm really curious to see if people even really remember the show. Like, I mean, they filmed the final runway show, what, like last month or something?
Yeah, it was. I think it was even more than that.
Yeah. So it's a really interesting turn of events, if you will.
Yes. We shall see.
Yes.
The next thing I have on our list is that the Screen Actors Guild's National Board of Directors has approved a contract, or a proposed contract, and is going to present it to the membership, which is always good when you hear that there's a potential for a deal to be done.
Yeah. Oh, we need another strike, like a hole in the head.
I remember when this news broke, I'm like, it wasn't even like a big piece of news, which is good.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't like this like monumentous, they struck a deal, it's going through. Instead, it's just kind of like, proposed contract. And that's kind of the nonchalant attitude you want to see in labor negotiations,
mm-hmm.
where it's kind of a preconceived notion that it's probably going to go through.
Yeah.
Like, none of them to go for a strike. And unless there was like a total deadlock, it just wasn't going to happen.
Exactly.
And then next, ABC is going to be bringing back Who Wants to Be a Millionaire in August for 13 episodes.
Ah, nostalgia.
Yeah, I would say like, oh, yay, nostalgia, if they didn't have an episode. Like, that airs every day, doesn't it?
Meredith Vieira, every
hour
day.
Episode. Yeah.
And like, and so they're bringing back Regis, and they're bringing back the format, trying to make it into a big summer event. And, you know, I think it could work. I think Slumdog Millionaire's success will be helpful to that.
Mm-hmm.
I think
mm-hmm.
that there's definitely, like, there's part of the culture that, you know, event television still works. You know, say what we will about Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and the way it was oversaturated and the way the daytime show has kind of boiled it down even further, but there's something fascinating about A, trivia. We all love trivia. And B, placing and giving these people personality and watching them kind of succeed. It's all very, you know, basic TV viewer dynamics. And so it's not like the sign that ABC has become creatively bankrupt, but at the same time I can see how some might be a little bit averse to the fact that, you know, they're willing to bring back Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, but they're canceling Pushing Daisies and they're canceling.
And the thing of it is too, like, they're not airing it instead of like
exactly
new, like, stuff. They're airing it in like a lead up to it, because like they have a lot of good stuff coming next season. Flash Forward is my favorite pilot that I've ever read, so
yeah. And Flash Forward's getting a little bit of a boost by Loss next week.
Exactly.
So, I mean, like, ABC knows what they're doing, and it feels like after the strike last year created a really weird development season that all mm-hmm. the networks have to consider what they're doing. Like, they really have to consider that they're now – they don't have an excuse anymore. They can't say, oh, you know, the strike, that's why our shows didn't really launch very well. Instead, they've got to make sure that this pilot season sticks. And for ABC, 15 million viewers a night for Who Wants to Be a Millionaire is a huge platform in which to launch the shows.
Exactly. Exactly.
Hopefully they can do better in launching this next fall season than they've done launching this mid-season, because while a lot of the shows have been good, the audience just hasn't come out to watch.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think there's two problems with that. I mean, I think one of the problems is the fact that they really only have one lead-in in Dancing with the Stars.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that is that the competition show gets a lot of viewers, so Castle's kind of not doing too bad, or so having Suburbia, but we'll forget that show exists.
Yeah.
But then, you know, if you look at the Tuesday results show, it doesn't get the same, because people don't really care that much.
They realized that Kivo through to the end, or whatever.
Exactly. Like, you know, it's, and so because of that, Cupid's struggling, and Lost has never launched a show in its life. It's incapable of doing it as great as it is. So based on that, it's like ABC doesn't have anything to go on, and they already took the Grey's Anatomy slot to make sure Private Practice stayed alive. So
which
they've had
I would
to
be
make
perfectly
some
happy if that show died, but it's not.
Oh, I'd be entirely happy with that, but clearly they're not, because they want another franchise. They want to make it work, and I'm really curious to see what happens next season when they're having to make the same kind of decisions of where they play shows and how they operate with them. And the way in which they'll do that, Millionaire might be the first part of a bigger puzzle, or they might have no idea what they're doing, and Millionaire is a grasp at former glory and intent to achieve. I don't know how networks work with it.
I would just love at like one time to be sort of that fly on the wall where you could sit in one of the network, you know, rooms where they're making these decisions, just to see what actually goes into how they decide what they're going to keep, what they're not going to keep, how they're going to schedule things. I think that would just be an incredible thing to see happen in mm-hmm. like in front of you.
Yeah. Until you find it, of course, it's just a dartboard.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Or, you know, some sort of like Wheel of Fortune wheel with show names on it instead of dollar amounts.
And yes, you turn out that According to Jim has like 17 entries on that Wheel of Fortune board. That's why I keep getting.
And at CBS, it's a Plinko board.
Yeah, CBS though, theirs is like, they've got nothing that they can get rid of. I mean, they're gonna get rid of stuff. No, it's gonna happen. But like, they know what they're doing. And
yeah, like they've got two spots on that schedule that have been problematic for them, and they eliminated one of them this year. And pretty much the shows that are being eliminated are the ones that are too expensive in this economic climate, despite getting far better ratings than anything else on any other network.
Yeah, I know. That's the bizarre thing of it.
And that's so frustrating for, you know, it must be really frustrating for the creators who's like, if we were on NBC, we'd be like their number one show.
Exactly.
And yet because we're on CBS, we can't do anything.
And speaking of CBS, the last thing I have listed is The New Adventures of Old Christine is sitting once again on the bubble. But ABC is in talks with Warner Brothers to pick it up if CBS should decide to cancel it.
Now, I like the show. I really do. I think that it's really funny. But ABC needs to concentrate more on making their own comedies and supporting their own comedies. Because if they're going to pick up a show like, you know, Old Christine or whatever, but not really give Better Off Ted a better chance to, like, have a good platform, I don't know. I don't know. I guess it makes business sense because there's already a built-in audience, but I don't know. I just don't.
Well, and I think it's really tough too because, you know, I mean, they just picked up Scrubs. You know, that was one of those things that they've hung on to that for forever. They've always said they're going to do it, and it's almost like they felt obligated. Mm-hmm. And it feels like in this instance, at the very least, I think that they actually have some financial backing behind it. That there's some logical reasons that they know it's always going to get some pretty good critical attention because of Julia Louis-Dreyfus. That the industry likes the show. Somewhat so, but at the same time, it's kind of like sitting at that point where CBS, like we said, have very different standards than ABC, but at the same time, to me, they also have a very different viewer dynamic. Mm-hmm. And if ABC wants to be able to create its own comic identity, just taking a show from CBS and saying, "Eh, we'll just put this in here," isn't really going to work. And you know, with a show like Better Off Ted, you see ABC really, I think, having, you know, something to build on and something to say, look, here's where we have a potential here, working with Scrubs. But then I don't really know if I can blame them for, I guess, throwing in the towel when, you know, Motherhood and Samantha, who are struggling so much on Thursdays, and Scrubs never really kicked off. It's like, you know, they're looking for a total reboot. I guess part of me doesn't blame them for saying, here's an already established show. Let's anchor it on this and then bring in more women-driven comedies for this night. And then kind of, you know, cut our losses elsewhere.
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny how well, like, ABC does with, like, with drama, like emotional drama and even character drama on Lost. Like, they do well with those kind of things. And I think that their pilots are kind of pointing that way, too. But they just can't do comedy. They cannot do it.
And it doesn't really make any sense because, you know, they should be able to do that. Like, you know, Grey's Anatomy.
I mean, Samantha was great and Pusha T's. Like, they just don't know how to support it.
No, and like even the comedy on Grey's Anatomy can be very strong on occasion. Mm-hmm. It's not consistent. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, you know, you'd think that especially the women who are the main audience of that show, they see that. You'd think that they'd see the commercials for, say, Samantha Who or something else and say, you know what? That's a good way to, you know, that's a good show too. Let's kind of look towards that. But it just seems like they're not open to it. That whatever audience they're drawing for the rest of their shows isn't willing to expand their horizons beyond the melodrama.
Exactly.
Well, and in some cases, it seems that they have difficulty expanding from one of their to another one, you know, to another melodrama, or you know, or type of thing that they've had. You would think shows like Cupid and Castle would fit, you know, more into that, but they haven't been able to draw as well as you would have hoped they would have.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, I think it's, you know, this issue of, you know, is that all people associate ABC with? And if it is, you know, if they just look at it for those reasons, you know, they're going to look at a show like Castle and say, well, why isn't this on CBS?
Exactly.
Like, this would be a perfect fit to kind of fit there. But it seems like they're associating watching the network before they're watching the show. And that, you know, if they're having to choose between CSI Miami and Castle, they chose CSI Miami, and when CSI Miami was in repeats, Castle suddenly shot straight up. I don't think that's a coincidence. I think it's because they, A, were creatures of habit, and B, because there is something associated with ABC that doesn't draw you to that kind of show. And I'm really curious to see, you know, like in these networks attempt to rebrand themselves, CBS doesn't have, never has to try. They just are what they are. Whereas ABC is this one thing, but they can't sustain themselves on that. You know, they saw so many shows fail this year, they're going to have to kind of revamp this. But, you know, this year they kind of tried to do that too. They had, like, you know, Life on Mars, this big, high-profile sci-fi drama. It kind of failed. So when they're going forward with Flash Forward, excuse the pun, they have the ability, I think, to kind of say, do we want to Brandon Knight on sci-fi? Wait a second, we did that last year and it failed. Right. And how do they rectify that? How do they, you know, come to terms with that? I don't know. And I don't know if they can.
I feel like there's no answer. Like, I really do. No. I feel like there's just, unless they scrap everything and start fresh, I just, even that doesn't help them. So who knows?
No.
Well, none of us here would be the average TV watcher. So
true.
We're in how we watch TV. And so it always is kind of an odd thing to me is I don't even think networks necessarily. I always think, that's a really good show, you know, and it looks good. I'm going to try it out and see whether it is or not, whether it's on ABC, NBC, CBS, you know, Fox or CW, or it's on one of the many cable channels out there.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, the more people are watching TV and the internet, the less there's, like Hulu as an example, the less they're associating with network. And I think, you know, I knew a bunch of people who caught up on How I Met Your Mother, and they finally got to the point where they were up to new episodes, and then all of a sudden they're sitting there, it's like, wait a second, what network is him on? And when I told them CBS, they didn't believe me.
Yeah.
Like, they couldn't believe that this was a CBS show because they had, as a discerning TV viewer, viewed CBS comedy as Two and a Half Men. And they associated it with that, and that was the end of it. And it's just kind of like, you know, How I Met Your Mother had to fight against that in a way, same way it had to fight against being a multi-camera show in a single-camera comedy world from a discerning perspective. So the way those kind of dynamics change, the more networks come into the equation, the more it becomes about archetypes and stereotypes, etc., the more those are removed, Jason, like you said, maybe it becomes about quality, and maybe that's the world we want to live in. And maybe that's why, you know, maybe the age of cable and the age of the internet will kind of wipe out, if not the networks themselves, then at least the idea of network identity.
Right.
Hmm. I'm all for any shot of quality TV getting a shot to stay in production so that I can continue to enjoy the show.
Agreed.
So what's our topic?
Well, our topic was sent in by Shannon.
Shannon! Woo!
Which was part of her manifesto that she sent in about a month back. But I'll read part of it here. She says she's interested in hearing us talk about the ways and reasons that a show may decline. She wants to know, is the show really declining, or is it just me as the viewer? It seems that there are so many shows that I know I used to love that I am barely hanging on to at the moment, and I'm really just watching out of loyalty to how I used to feel about the show. Some examples. She cites Heroes as one that she admits that the writing has gone downhill, but she remembers totally loving the show and wonders how it went off the rails. And another one she mentions is Grey's Anatomy. She says for the most part she still likes the show, but she doesn't enjoy the episodes as much as she used to. And she also mentions the Denny debacle as part of that reasoning. She also mentions The Office, that she's not enjoying it as much as she used to. She says it hasn't fallen off nearly as much as the other shows that she's mentioned, but it does seem to be missing something, and that it used to be a appointment TV for her. And she closes off with, maybe I'm asking an unanswerable question, and every show is different because at the same time there are certain shows that for me never seem to falter, like Lost, Supernatural, Battlestar Galactica. These shows might have an off episode or two, but for the most part, my excitement for a new episode has never let up during their entire run. Anyway, that is my suggestion for a topic. So basically, is when a show seems to be in decline, is it you or is it the show?
Well,
I think it depends on the show.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Like, speaking, it depends on the show. Heroes, it's the show. It's not you.
Very much.
Show. Definitely the show. But, like, in a case of The Office, I think it may be Shannon. Because they have, like, few off moments here and there. But that's still a show that I get really excited to watch every week.
Yeah.
Even if they have an off episode.
Well, what I always find really interesting about The Office is it's also, like, what kind of show do you want The Office to be? Because it can be very different shows week to week. It can be this really kind of bittersweet investigation of this naive character coming to terms with his innocence and, you know, not knowing what he's doing, kind of almost like an emotional kind of heartfelt sign, or it can be this very broad comedy. And when it kind of flits back and forth between them, Michael Scott being the character that kind of changes the most, I can totally see how in an extended period of one or the other, some viewers are going to start drifting away from it. And what I find interesting about The Office, though, I agree that it has a lot of diversity to it. And that because it can flip between those things fairly easily, you do feel like it's offering you enough surprise, enough interest to keep watching. And I definitely haven't, you know, stopped kind of looking forward to those episodes. Whereas with Heroes, like, they were just going – they went on a path. Like, we cannot fault them for not, you know, deciding on a path and sticking to it. The problem is that it was the fundamentally wrong path, and they stuck to it for two seasons, and they should have stuck to it for about three episodes.
And they just can't get out of the problem they've gotten themselves into.
No, and, like, I mean, like, I always, you know, find it interesting, you know, again, like, you know, the whole, like, you know, it's not you, it's me kind of argument. The thing about Heroes is it had ample chance. You know, it had the strike that interrupted it. It had the chance to reboot the third season once over. It completely changed creative partners. They even brought back Brian Fuller. But what became really clear is that, you know, at a certain point, you can't fix it. Like, with a serialized show like that, you can't just suddenly stop and say, oh, you know what, you know, the show's going to get good again. When you've created so many problems, unless you do a total reboot, it's just not going to happen. And as that kind of takes place, you know, certain shows can bounce back a little bit better from that. Like, you know, The Office likes to disrupt itself all the time. It just finished an arc all about creating this disruption, but it's really good at resolving that. And at Heroes, they just stopped resolving anything.
And the thing too, like with a show like she mentions Lost being a show she's very excited about. I don't think that if Lost hadn't introduced, if they hadn't introduced flash forwards or a game changer like they did at the end of season three, I don't think that'd be the case. I think that a lot of people would have gotten, like, because Lost was going down a path where they had exhausted, like, we were seeing like a day in the life of Kate Austin, and even flashbacks for Kate still are a little low for me, like.
Yeah.
But they changed it so drastically where they had a clear – and it helped that they have an endpoint and they know where they're ending.
That definitely helped. And, like, I remember reading an interview, I think, by Alan Sepin while he was talking to Damon Lindelof. And, like, Damon Lindelof says, that much maligned episode where Jack – you know, they talk about Jack's tattoos. Like, Lindelof basically delivered that to the network and said, this is your show. Like, if we don't do something at this point, this is the show you're going to get. So you need to be able to let us, you know, expand beyond this format, introduce some bigger ideas, make a game changer, a rattlesnake in the mailbox, whatever you want to call it, that we need to be able to do that or else this is the show you're going to be left with. And it feels like they were really self-aware about that. And I think the problem is that some shows aren't self-aware. And I think, you know, to get to Shannon's mention of Grey's Anatomy, that's a show where Shonda Rhimes does not know what she's doing.
Right.
I don't think she knows what viewers want. I don't think she knows how things are going to work. I think that, you know, for a showrunner who at the very beginning seemed to be really open and have a lot of interesting ideas, has demonstrated again and again over the past few years that she is entirely fallible, that in every possible way that show's problems can really be traced to her and her alone.
Exactly. Exactly. And because the writers buy into this idea that Shonda Rhimes is, like, so great – because maybe in the beginning she was kind of, you know, the be-all, end-all. Now they have the writers kind of drinking the Kool-Aid and talking about how Grey's Anatomy is still on top. And it's just anything can be traced back to Shonda. She says, you know, like, everything is traced back to her.
And I think Private Practice, you know, is a fun example of that. Like, they're like, okay, we can spin off Addison. And it's just like, you know, do you not realize how that's going to change the dynamic on Grey's? And, right. you know, how Grey's felt like a totally more lively show when she came back for that little kind of, you know, crossover period. Because, you know, she was an important part of that dynamic. And to say, well, she's a great actress, and Kate Walsh is a great actress, let's spin her off, is the kind of move where you're thinking, you know, how can we get the most out of this possible? And sometimes you can't think on those terms. And, like, it really felt like for Lost, you know, like, you could have technically said, well, let's, you know, send a character back to the island and let's do a spinoff. Like, have Lost be one show and then have a couple characters go off and do their own. You could theoretically have done that. And I'm pretty sure that if Lindelof and Cuse had gone to ABC with it, ABC would say, great, that sounds awesome. But they're not going to do that because it's the worst idea in the history of time because it dilutes everything. Like, you know, those are the kind of scenarios that could theoretically happen if you have a showrunner who is delusional enough to believe their own hype and to, you know, overextend themselves. And that's where you kind of have to remember that, you know, you as a viewer are kind of, I guess, held hostage to those kinds of, you know, delusions. The showrunners have a great deal of control over the show themselves, and, you know, sometimes they're just going to kind of go off on a tangent, and we kind of have to accept the fact that it's not that our tastes are changing every time. And our tastes do change. It's entirely possible that they're just screwing up.
I think with Addison, not only did it change the dynamic on Grey's, but the spinoff, like, changed her character. Like, she became not as good a character in the new setting as she was in the previous setting.
Exactly.
So it kind of killed things a little bit on both ends. I think for some extent, though, for Grey's, it's you put something out there like the Denny thing and some of what was happening there, and that so pushes the show off the rails when that's happening that you miss some of the other stuff that was still pretty good.
That's true. We've talked about this a lot because, like, the Denny thing killed it.
Yeah, so I think sometimes you can have an element that just so overshadows that it makes you feel like the show is not as good as it used, or you don't enjoy, you know, that it takes away from your enjoyment of it, even though the other, you know, say 80% of the show is still really good. And then sometimes I think with shows is that, like we were talking about there with the Lost, with the, you know, having changing things up, it's not really the show. It is end up being us, as in that the show continues to produce sort of the same quality as it's always done, but 3 or 4 years in, it becomes repetitive. And while it's still really good, it's like you've seen it. You know, you've already been there, done that type of thing. And so in that case, I would say that the quality of the show hasn't necessarily gone down, but in your estimate of your enjoyment of the show, it has gone down because they're still doing the same thing.
Yeah, like, you know, just, you know, I've like three metaphors going around in my head for some reason. I have no idea why. But, like, one of them, you know, is the whole idea, like, you know, like, let's say, like, an amusement park builds a new attraction. When it first comes out, it's this, like, huge deal, and there's all these lines and everything. And while it might never change, over time, it's no longer the attraction that it once was.
Oh,
and
sure.
I think it's totally justified that some shows kind of go through that experience. But what I think is something that I always find interesting is, like, how do you kind of keep that from happening? And when I was at the Big Bang Theory panel at PaleyFest, you know,
oh my God, they were
it was
so
just hilarious. I loved it to death, and it's going to make me watch the show, which I didn't do before. And what I find really interesting, though, is that I don't trust Chuck Lorre with that show's future. Because of his past examples of 2.5 Men and everything else, I feel like he was talking like, you know, he has this big 2-season order, this chance to kind of think big and to consider kind of changes in the dynamic. And while I understand that right now the show is extremely funny, that the cast is great together and all of this, he didn't even seem open to any, not necessarily a game changer, but any sort of expansions of that in the future. And it just seems like he was really closed off to it. And to me, that's how this happens. Like,
that's
to me,
true.
That's how it happens when this takes place, where, you know, there might be a point, like, say, a season into that 2-season order, where they really do need to shake things up because viewers are getting frustrated, but yet they're so set on that because they say, oh, okay, it's working now, why would it not work in the future, that they might miss something like a Denny. They might miss something like that. That might seem like a good idea in some context, but that might be missing a key element puzzle.
That's true, because, like, I think a lot of the Denny thing, too, for Shonda Rhimes, it was like a, I love Jeffrey Dean Morgan. The pilot we did together didn't go. He's free. Let's write him in, and then we'll figure out the story. And I think that's Chuck Lorre's case, too, because he finds a guest star and then writes the story about it. So he could run the risk of, like, maybe disrupting a story he does put in motion because one of his favorite guest stars becomes available.
And I don't think there's anything, like, fundamentally wrong with that. Like, you can do that. Like, you know, it's nepotism. It's, you know, and all sorts of, you know, really kind of good actors and actresses, you know, get jobs that way. No question.
Exactly.
But I do think that there's ways that that can be kind of more thought out and better integrated that, you know, sometimes a really quick TV schedule doesn't give you time for. And exactly. I understand that, like, but then, again, like Shannon said, there's a difference between shows that start going completely off the rails and one that has a bad episode every now and then. It's that ability to course correct that is really important and that I fear some producers have and some producers don't.
Yeah, it would be nice knowing that you're going to be around for a couple seasons, although nothing's ever guaranteed, even with a renewal like that, but that if you think about, like, what you might want to do over the course of two seasons, like, where would you like to see these characters be in two seasons, and sort of go on that journey, but while still, you know, keeping the things that make the show funny,
keeping the DNA intact.
Right.
And I think what was really frustrating with the Big Bang Theory panel was they're like, you know, we don't think these characters have any chance for personal growth. And when they said that, I'm just kind of sitting there thinking to myself, but isn't that kind of, you know, the point? Like, aren't we looking to see that kind of growth? And if you have this long period of time, you know the show's going to run for likely, like, beyond, like, the bottom dropping out, like, at least four seasons. You know, you want to be able to say from season one to season four that something has changed. Not fundamentally changed, but that there's been growth of some sort. To me, that's a really simple television principle, and for them to say they're going to ignore that makes me concerned about what's going to happen. If something starts not working, if a dynamic changes, which is not to say, oh, I'm not going to watch that show anymore, it's doomed to failure, but I don't want it to become a situation like Grey's Anatomy did. I don't want to go through the experience that Shannon did with these shows, where you're sitting there questioning, okay, is it just me, or is this show not failing in some way?
Right.
Yeah, because in some respects, with a show like that, that if you are four seasons into a show, and the characters have shown no growth, just so that you can keep that same exact dynamic that creates the comedy now.
You mean like Two and a Half Men?
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. Like, that's my concern.
Well, like, on this season, they've given Charlie, a fiancé. But it's almost treated like that's never happened before. But this is not the first time his character has, you know, so-called fallen in love and, you know, proposed to somebody or almost been close to marriage or something like that. So they keep going through and doing things, and then they leave everybody right back where they were, where I think you can still find the funny and move characters along. Because if Leonard, you know, and the gang are still sitting playing video games every night with just the four of them, you know, like four or five seasons from now, that's not really what you want to see from those characters. You want to see them grow into, you know, out of their shell.
Like, you know, we're rooting for them. There's no question about that. Like, you know, even from the panel and the episode I saw, having not seen too many, I'm like, you know, I want these characters to succeed. I want them to do this. I want them to achieve these goals. But I want that to happen, you know, over time. I want to see it take place. I don't want to just keep hoping for the rest of the series' run. And hope can only get you so far. And, you know, and there comes a time when you're not just saying, oh, I hope that happens. You're saying, come on, happen already. And that was kind of the situation where you knew Denny would eventually leave on Grey's Anatomy, but Shonda Rhimes dragged that out for so long that...
And called it the most amazing story she's ever written.
And I have no idea where the logic, you know, involved in that. But what I find really interesting is that not even on some other shows, you know, the whole idea of, like, will they, won't they relationships has the same problem. And, you know, as much as we all love Chuck and it's amazing, there was a certain point in the season where I found Chuck and Sarah got to that point where it stopped necessarily being this organic growth, and it started being, okay, we get it already, stop resetting the clock and stop taking it back. And But at the same time, you know, just in, you know, not to spoil too much about Chuck when we're not really talking about Chuck, but they've made some really good strides in that direction to the point where I was watching this week's episode and I swore it was a dream sequence because I was convinced that they couldn't possibly give me what I was looking for because they had kind of been teasing it for so long. But, you know, the show knows when to deliver. And the problem is that some shows don't end up delivering. They're, you know, all build up and no payoff, and then you just circle back to the beginning and pretend they didn't build up at all.
Well, I think the answer to the unanswerable question is that it depends on the show.
And I think that's our answer. I feel like at every topic we say, well, it really depends on the show.
Yeah. I think there's some shows that, like Heroes, have declined. And there's some shows, like Grey's Anatomy, that have an element about them or...
a cancer, if you will.
That takes away from them. Plus, they're still doing... the rest of the show is still doing the same thing that they've always done,
right?
For the most part, with the added cancer. And then you have, you know, a show like The Office that I think it's more, it can be hit or miss. You can have a couple of down episodes, but then I think like this last arc has been, you know, really good. And so I think it really does come down to the show. And sometimes it is the show and sometimes it's you.
Yes.
So if Shannon was looking for us to ease her conscience and really kind of decide it for her, we apologize. We really can't.
We have done nothing to help you.
It's Shannon, the ultimate yes and no answer.
Or, you know, we could always just say that it's you, you know.
Yeah.
It's not
Shannon,
the shows. It has nothing to do with the shows. They're all high quality. They're as good as they've ever been.
We can shift from a television podcast to a psychology podcast.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And now we'll shift to talking about Primetime, and first show up that we just got to mention anyways was Chuck.
It can never have too many mentions.
It can never have too many mentions. And the first thing I want to say is, like, yay, internet, for coming together and trying to save Chuck. Like, it's a really organic save Chuck kind of thing. I'm seeing it everywhere, and I haven't seen it everywhere for other shows like this. Like, yes, for Jericho, people were sending things in, but I didn't see it as it's popping up on like 75. I follow 300 people on Twitter, and you know, some of them don't know other people, but they're all retweeting things about Chuck.
Yeah,
it's all coming from different areas, and I just think that that's awesome.
Well, and I think it's interesting, like, you know, I found myself really by happenstance in the middle of the whole Jericho phenomenon when I wrote a really critical piece where I'm like, you know, of course Jericho would get canceled. Here's all the reasons why, and get all sorts of hate comments. And after that, I'm like, hey, these people seem pretty passionate. Let's kind of start engaging with this. And I got all caught up in the middle of it. And what I found really interesting about that was that for the most part, because critics didn't like the show, and justifiably, really, considering that it seems as if, you know, I didn't dislike the show, but it wasn't, right. You know, it had some really creative issues. And because of that, it seemed like because the critics weren't behind it, the mainstream media viewed it as this really, like, fan phenomenon, where it's just like these nut bars are sending in, well, nuts. And, you know, they're a little bit crazy.
It was
a wacky human interest story in a lot of ways. Whereas with Chuck, it's about the show. It's about what the show is bringing out in people. It's about the way the show is kind of, you know, achieving these goals. And I felt really bad that I was on vacation when the Save Chuck thing really started picking up. So I never really got to contribute as much as I would have wanted to. But I'm planning a manifesto of sorts this weekend where I just want to wax, you know, poetic about the show for as long as physically possible, because it's been really good the last few weeks, and just it's great. And to see other people realizing that is, you know, fingers crossed, no question.
Exactly. And by the time this is probably out, the finale will have aired. I mean, assuming this doesn't go up on Monday morning. But I just, from what I'm hearing, you know, the finale is, and Chris Fedak is calling it cataclysmic. Is that the word? Cataclysmic?
Yeah.
And saying that, like, you can't end it with this episode. So
the satisfying finale ever.
So let's actually talk about the episode.
Oh, man.
This is the one where Devin, spoiler alert, stop listening, finds out that Chuck is a spy.
When it happened, I'm like, is this really going to happen? Is he really going to tell him? Does this work? But then I realized after the fact that, you know, it's the perfect choice.
Because Devin is... Kath and I have been talking about that, like, back and forth. Like, he is the perfect choice.
Like, no one else could do it. Because he's the one character who is such... He's so technically, like, ridiculous, you know, and being Captain Awesome and having this perspective. But in reality, he's maybe the most grounded character the show has because he's so simple and that he loves Ellie and that he wants to protect her and that he does good, that he's good on his job, that he's, like, you know, so kind of straight-laced, kind of forward, that for him to have this information, have to deal with this secret, he would both, A, think it's awesome, which is an important factor, and that, right. B, he wouldn't feel, like, too burdened by it because his character has always kind of been a little bit on the outside a bit ridiculous and on the inside a bit deeper. So
I need you to be awesome. Yeah. And like he was like, that's awesome, you're awesome.
So I was like, I knew you weren't just a loser at the Buymore. They were working at the Buymore.
He's like, well, like, that is my job, but okay.
Loser's a bit harsh, but you know, just kind of.
And I think I like to. They have this whole, you know, it's kind of built up that Sarah and Chuck will have this relationship and they will be in love. And it's kind of how it's been from the beginning. But the fact that John Casey was so upset because they didn't include him and then immediately turned and like he, too, has grown like a relationship with Chuck. And I think that's important. Like, I think it's really important that Adam Baldwin gets to play that, too.
Yeah, because you didn't like that. You were watching the episode and you're like, dude, what's with this? I thought he had, like, come around, kind of. Yeah. And then you find out that it wasn't really the promotion and stuff like that. He was more pissed off that they didn't ask him to come along with them than it, you know, keeping the team together than it was, you know, that he was actually going after this, following orders and
exactly.
Getting the promotion. I thought that was a great moment in the episode.
And I want to say, the music on that show... I just can't even get over it. Creature Feature is the new Skinny Love for me. Like, Bon Iver is, like, just my new favorite band. I love their CD. And so the fact that they use them in all these really emotional moments, like, it's just awesome. Alex, I love you.
It's so consistent, too. Mm-hmm. Like, there's something about it where, you know, they've created this, you know, voice through the music for the show. So those moments, you know, they start to connect and... You know, different uses. And I loved, you know, in the episode a couple weeks ago when they had Hungry Like the Wolf playing in the flash for just a second. And it was like, ha-ha, you know, this is kind of funny. But then it actually pops up in the soundtrack. So, you know, it starts to give you this kind of, you know, where it's not just, you know, oh, look, they soundtracked that scene with this piece of music. But that it's actually part of the show's identity kind of moving forward. And that's where you want, when you have a show that relies more on, you know, actual songs than it does on compositions, you want that kind of organic kind of feel to it. And that scene was so well soundtracked. Like I said, I thought it was a dream sequence. Like, when it started, I'm like, this can't be happening. You know, they've waited so long. It's just, it just can't be. But when I realized, wait a second, you know, they're not pulling out of this. You know, this actually appears to be happening. It was just kind of this realization of, okay, they're really going there. This episode is really going to be that big. And that it also dealt so much with Casey and with Sarah and the relationship with Chuck. And Zachary Levi was great in the episode. It was just really, really good.
I just wish, and my main complaint always is that I wish they would do more with Ellie. And they're going to go that way. And hopefully, you know, in next season, we'll see. Next season, I'm speaking positively because I want it to come back.
Oh, yeah. No. Let's not speak negatively at all. Just next season.
Absolutely. Like, next season, I hope that they figure out kind of more what to do. Because Sarah Lancaster, she can kill it. She is fantastic.
She's so good.
I hated her character on Everwood, and then somehow she became my favorite because of Sarah Lancaster.
Yeah, and it's amazing how it can really happen, you know, that, you know, like, and I'm really curious to see, though, that, you know, if they have to have, let's say, when the third season order comes, there's going to be concessions that are made, whether it's a smaller episode order or whether it's cast cuts. And I want to make sure they resist trying to cut Ellie and Awesome out of the
show.
Especially
now that Awesome knows. Like, with Awesome knowing, cut him out.
And to me, like, you know, and at the same time, you know, you can't really cut the Buy More stuff either. But, you know, the whole reason Alias went downhill was when they eliminated Sydney's social life and her social circle. Like, as soon as it became less about her and dealing with her friends and her family and more about just her dealing with her job, the heart of the show left. and it started going off in these different directions. There was nothing to ground it. And while Chuck, I find, doesn't have quite the same problem in the fact that it treats the spy stuff as a bit more trifling, and that's good because it's a more lighthearted comedy. Nonetheless, having Ellie and Awesome to fall back on, and even now kind of even like it's dangerous to have Awesome kind of in between, but even as long as Ellie's there as this kind of innocent kind of moving around them, as long as they maintain their same relationships, that is a huge part of the show's identity.
Exactly.
And I just hope that I would rather have a third season than, you know, I would be willing to, you know, give up on it if I had to, but I really hope that it doesn't come down to that, because that would be a huge detriment to the show.
Exactly. I agree. So, long story short, save Chuck.
That's right.
Woo-woo.
Long live the Chuck.
Yes.
Okay. And another show in the same time slot on Mondays is Greek.
Aren't they all in the same time slot?
Everything. that first hour of prime time on Mondays is... It's got some of, like, I don't know, probably five... out of my top 10 shows might fall in that one time frame.
Yeah. it's actually fundamentally ridiculous. And I think if there's ever been an argument for a cable-style 12-month season, I think that would be it. Just so that conflict wouldn't become this huge issue, and shows that could get a fan base, that could get viewers, could air at a time that made more sense. Like, I almost wish they would have... I'm really loving Greek this season, but I almost wish they would have kept it till summer just so that it wasn't in conflict with everything else on television.
Exactly. Exactly. I agree 100%.
Plus, it's a really good summer show.
It is. I mean, it's funny that the show that's all about, you know, college, when everybody's on break, the show is... It just has a summer feel to it. Like, it's... I don't know. I had the chance, the wonderful opportunity, to go on the set on Thursday last week.
So jealous.
I know. And I got to meet, you know, Cappy, and I got to meet Rebecca, and I got to meet the creator. And it's just such a show that people relate to. So I wish that, like, it wasn't against a powerhouse like House, and it wasn't against comedies on CBS, which are getting the ratings. Like, I just wish that it could find a home, because it should be, by all accounts, the top-rated show on ABC Family, because it just should be. The crap that they're putting on there, it should be, and it deserves more.
You taking a shot at Secret Life there?
I'm always taking a shot at Secret Life.
Like, if you ever want to know what Ambry's doing at a particular time, she is doing Thing X and taking a shot at Secret Life.
That's an understood in my Twitter updates.
No, like, and I find it really interesting, too, that, like, and this is another show, like I was talking about earlier, where they're like, oh, they're catching up on online and doing all this, like, what network is this show on? And when I say ABC Family, they laugh me out of the room. Because it's just like, why would a good show be on ABC Family?
Exactly.
And I was actually, I ran into a colleague of mine, she was packing up to go home from school, and she kind of almost, like, embarrassed, she's almost embarrassed, she kind of looked back when I asked what she was watching, and she's like, Greek? And just kind of like this kind of grimace when she said, I'm like, I love Greek. She's like, oh, good. I was afraid I was going to get judged for it. But it's just such a fun little show. And, like, I have my issues with the show. Don't get me wrong. I greatly dislike Casey in a lot of her romantic scenarios. I find that when the show starts to revolve around Casey as if she's the son, I have serious issues with that logic. However, like, this week's episode for me was the best of the season, primarily because it put everyone in some really great dynamics that we don't always see, and yet the show was just as good.
Exactly.
Like, throwing Evan and Cappy back together shouldn't have worked, should have been this huge drama fest, but it actually made me relate to Evan a lot more, which I shouldn't be doing because his character went through a whole character suicide thing last year that didn't do him any good, but yet I felt for him a little bit here because Cappy was there, because Cappy was relating to it, because you kind of have that whole dynamic, and they really know how to use those characters in the right situation. And I mean, like, I should hate Rebecca by and large based on what happened in the first season, but yet I actually like her right now.
Oh, I love
her more than any other female character.
Yeah, I love her. It helps that I know her now, because she's hilarious.
Yes, that is helpful. But
I like the dynamic, though, between her and Casey, though. The whole bit with them trying to get the truth out of Ashley, and then Ashley talking about how, you know, Casey had gone from Cappy to Evan, and, you know, and then Rebecca had gone from, you know, to or to Max, and then Evan. She said Evan to Cappy to, and she's like, if you say Max, you know, I will cut her.
Well, no, like that's one of those things where it's like, you know, like I hated at the beginning of the season the even idea that Rebecca was a turncoat, but when they revealed that she was a double agent, it was so much fun.
Exactly.
Like, that was such a fun little turn, and that's what the show has kind of kept doing. And, you know, for me, you know, anyone who's watching Gossip Girl over Greek at this point needs to wake up a little bit. Like, because for me, Gossip Girl, what it pretends to be, which is just like, you know, real kind of, you know, melodrama and doing all that, it is failing miserably at really engaging with these teenagers' characters and as actual teenagers. And Greek is so good at doing that, even when they're not actual real teenagers, even when they're actually in university. But they so much better engage with their human sides that the show is just blowing Gossip Girl out of the water right now.
And what I said to Sean, the creator, the other day, I was like, your characters have flaws. Like, real flaws. Like,
yeah.
And they're not, they don't shy away from them. Whereas on Gossip Girl, which, you know, I watch it off and on, they have flaws, but like to a really sick degree. And
yeah.
Beak is like so, Casey can't make up her mind. She doesn't know where she wants to be in her life. Everyone goes through that.
Oh, yeah. Like, I can't
help
but relate.
Not everyone goes through, my dad sold everybody out, and now I have to date 6 women, plus a cougar, plus I have to stare dreamily at my best friend. Like, not everybody has to go through that, Nate Archibald. No.
Well, and I think, you know, like if we look at Evan and Nate as quite similar characters in a way, you know, both being very rich, both having struggles with their family and doing all this, but it's the difference at which they engage with that. And with mm-hmm. Evan, it's very personal. It's about how is he fitting within this universe. It's not, you know, what's like, how is the influence of the world around me taking place? And I think that's what's kind of important, is that Gossip Girl is so caught up in, you know, the crazy New York lifestyle and what it does to these kids, which is an interesting point of investigation, but one that's most often squandered. With Greek, you actually have it being, how are these characters, I can't really call them kids, I'm only 23, but how do you get these kind of characters operating within that setting? And I think there's something really engaging about just seeing it on a very personal level. And
exactly.
The show doesn't overextend itself. And the only, you know, technically it's about, you know, it's the Greek system and how they operate within that. But they have so much fun with the Greek system that it never feels like there is like an investigation into the fraternity lifestyle or, you know, the dangers of sororities, that it actually is just now about the characters and that it's evolved so much since it started. And I mean, this show for me may have started as a guilty pleasure, but it's gone far beyond that right now. Guilty is not the right word for it.
And the thing about this past week's episode, you know, the whole Jesse McCartney gets so drunk from beer pong that he passes out and can't make it to football practice. Like, any other sappy trying to appeal to, like, family drama might take that and make it into an after-school special about too much drinking at a frat party. But they just made a joke about it, and then Cappy and Rusty, like, solved their issue. Like, they didn't glaze over it. They realized that, you know, he shouldn't be doing this, but they didn't cue the sad music and say, okay, we need to sit you down and have some kind of intervention.
Well, no, and they've really, I feel like they've done really good with the Jesse McCartney character overall, and that he hasn't been too much of like a disruptive force. Like, when I remember when the casting announcement came out, it felt like it was going to be like, you know, this new quarterback gets in between everyone and creates tension everywhere. but in reality, it's more like it gives Rusty the chance to learn that life lesson, not in an after school special kind of way, but in just, you know, responsible. Like, then I love the irony of Cappy giving the responsibility speech, because that's an irony that happens a lot in the show, where Cappy says far more intelligent things than he really should based on preconceived notions. But again, like, there's a character who is so much more deep. And like last season, just to go back for a bit, like the episode where Cappy had to take the women's study course because in order to like maintain the grades of the whatever the crazy scenario was, you know, that was an episode where that shouldn't have worked if Cappy was just a caricature, and it wouldn't have. But all of these characters have evolved beyond that point from their initial presentation, and yet there's so much history, like, you know, like Evan and Cappy in this week's episode, there's so much history, yet there's so much simplicity. It's just doing a really great balancing act, and it's unfortunate that, like, this is a show where because it's on ABC Family, people presume it's like, you know, Secret Life and shows like that, but it's so far beyond that, so far.
Exactly. So far.
It's kind of an odd show to be on. Well, I don't know. ABC Family has sort of has recently, over the last couple of years, has had sort of an odd mix of shows that you're like, you kind of, speaking of a network identity, you're like, why is this on a channel that has family, you know, in the title? Yeah. And so, but to expand just a little bit on that, I like those moments with Cappy. Those are what make the show great, I think, is that he's like trying to keep from growing up, but he really has learned some things over his, you know, time. And when he imparts that wisdom, there's been times in the show where they haven't had him do that, where he's like completely neglected Rusty. And those times like bother me more. And you're like, no, wait, he's supposed to like come through, you know, in the end. And, and so I really like that, that dynamic of the show when he does impart that wisdom and, you know, and the irony of it is one of the best elements of the show.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Wow. How many shows we've left to talk about? Like seven?
Yeah, no, we got a lot.
Something like that.
Next is Fringe that we have.
I read somewhere, I think it was Joe Pinionated on Twitter, said like, this is the episode, this is her walkabout. Because, you know, like with Lost, a lot of people weren't really in it until the Locke episode about the walkabout where we find out the Locke's in a wheelchair.
And which is an amazing episode.
It's an amazing episode, and that's where people really were like, okay, I am in it for the long haul. And I kind of feel like this last episode of Fringe, I am too. Like, this was my walkabout too.
Just that last, you know, last minute of the episode, you're like, wow. You know?
Yeah. And, like, to be honest, like, the episode didn't really engage me otherwise. Like, it was interesting, but it felt like a really small story, which is why you felt like there had to be something deeper here. And, like, I always love that interaction where it's just kind of like, you always know that Walter isn't saying everything he knows because he can't access it. Like, you know, I don't think he really has the ability to access all of his memories in the way that he should be able to, that normal people can.
That was also one of the great lines in the episode where she said, why does it feel like you're not telling me everything? And he's like, I don't know everything.
Yeah. And like that's a huge difference. So when it came to that final scene and, you know, it's revealed that, you know, Walter was more involved than he knows, I think. Like, I definitely don't think he had...
Yeah, you could see on, like, the face of John Noble as... Like, I kind of... The direction he probably got sitting there was, this is Olivia. Like, you're realizing this. You're re-watching this tape because something struck you as having happened.
Yeah, and this is new to you in the same way it would be new to Olivia.
Right.
Like, I don't think this is something that he had any real consciousness of. And that's the kind of thing where, like, and those are the dynamics that have almost always been there between the characters and that has always made Walter by far the most interesting. And... the more the show engages with those kinds of questions and, you know, to learn about, you know, the casting coming up, when they're actually going to get into William Bell and they're going to start engaging with those kinds of ideas, the more the show finds its center in Walter and places Olivia as almost a victim of that as opposed to, you know, just an observer from the outside kind of coming in, the better the show is going to be. Because it's going to feel like everyone's connected in that way. Whereas
and
if it's just...
It was his voice on that tape.
Oh, yeah.
It was his voice. Leonard Nimoy.
There's just some great things to come, no question.
Now, I think back to, like, do you remember in Alias, because we talked about it already today, like, they had that whole Sydney was a young child trained in the Christmas program.
Yeah, because they had the puzzle that she put together.
Right, but then I felt like they never really explored that fully enough. And I worried, you know, that this whole Olivia, she's kind of just brought in because she knew John. But as it turns out, they're going to kind of take the idea of this Sydney Bristow was in a Christmas experiment and expound on it with this Olivia character and really have her have a history that they're really going to explore.
Like, the show has felt a lot like Alias at a lot of different points.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's been a lot of kind of, like, especially the way the mythology has kind of started working itself in. And one of the things that's really interesting from the PaleoFest discussion, I was reading one of the recaps, and, you know, apparently at one point Joshua Jackson said that, you know, it's so much better to be on a show that's really, you know, that's aiming for the top and finishing in second than a show that's satisfied with mediocrity. And what I find really interesting about that statement is that I don't know how often Fringe is really shot for the top. Like, for the most part, the episodes are kind of content to maintain, like, to stay within this kind of smaller area. But it's moments like these where you realize that there is almost like an Alias-level amount of conspiracy being brought in here, where it's not overbearing, but it's kind of, they're starting to think big. And the more of that we see, And the more it doesn't overwhelm the rest of the show, the more I have faith in their ability to do it in the future. And I think, you know, I don't want them necessarily to rehash what Alias did, but I do think that Alias, like you're right, didn't do as much with that as they could have. And anything that makes Olivia more interesting, I'm totally in favor of.
I agree 100%.
I think they've sort of hit on a good balance, though, of keeping an episode to where you can enjoy an episode, whether you've necessarily watched every episode before it. But then there's also these moments like this that they add in, not to necessarily to every episode, but to lots of the episodes that continue the overall mythology of the show, the overall story arc that they're telling, and moves that story forward.
Exactly. And just as an example, the episode from – I just this week sat down and watched everything after the hiatus. So I sat down with the first episode, and I was watching it along, and I'm like, this is a really interesting story. It's a kid, so it's a little bit tragic. It's got this element to it. And then I was like, oh, you know, he's – you know, it's interesting. And I wasn't putting things together. And then when the car – we was driving by in the car, and he sees the observer out on the side of the road, and I'm like, wait a second. He just became an observer. Like the hairlessness and the hyper-awareness and the lack of senses. And I put all that together all of a sudden. It's like, you know, I could have watched that episode with no idea what any of that meant and enjoyed it for pretty much, you know, 90% of it. But that extra level made me totally connect it back to what we've seen in the past, how that's operated. And then it's like, okay, you know, this is a bigger show than I sometimes realize. And you can enjoy it on those two planes, and it doesn't feel like they're rubbing against each other or that there's, like, real conflict between them. They're both they're both coexisting. And that's a difficult kind of balance to set. And I think I'm impressed that, you know, after a bit of a hiatus, that they've come back with that sensibility still intact and that the end of the season isn't making them rush forward in one direction or the other.
Exactly.
It's that sensibility that Dollhouse wasn't able to get. You know, Fox wanted the show to start out that way with episodes that you could take as an individual episode, but they weren't able to mesh an overall story with a weekly episode.
And I think a lot of that has to do with two things. Number one, you know, don't let Eliza Dushku play in your TV show. It's a bad idea. But I think number two is just the fact that when you it seemed as if Dollhouse was too big an idea for that to work. That if they wanted that kind of show, Dollhouse's fundamental ideas needed to be more simple and needed to be more developed. Whereas with Fringe, like I remember, like Pillyfest, like they started at a very basic point with that show. And, you know, yes, they're cribbing on like how many other shows that do similar things, but I think that's allowing them to use a bit of shorthand so they're not too worried about their own kind of development. They can play on all these different elements like, you know, genre fiction and those kinds of areas while slowly starting to kind of come to terms with what they're doing. Whereas with Dollhouse, it's such an original idea, and that's great. I love it. I love what Whedon does. I think he's an incredibly intelligent writer. The problem is that he was so caught up in that world that he didn't know how to pull back from it, and it took him 6 episodes to do it, and TV doesn't work that way, and it's never going to work that way.
It may have worked that day when, you know, in the beginning, when Buffy the Vampire Slayer took 6 or 7 episodes to really get there. But that was 10 years ago. We were
That's
in a different
time.
Yeah.
Next is My Boys.
My Boys. We haven't talked about it yet this season since it started. So what are we, 3 episodes in?
4, I think.
What'd I miss?
Did you
see the decathlon episode?
Wait, was that this week?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, I haven't seen it, but you can talk about it.
Oh, it's the thing about My Boys is, what can you really spoil on My Boys?
Exactly.
Like,
it's just
like
fun.
I heard apparently, like when they sent out screeners of the premiere, they had like critics where they couldn't talk about certain things, like the big resolutions.
Like, don't talk about what happens at the wedding, and don't talk about the end of this episode, and
people who are watching My Boys for that stuff would fascinate me. Like, I want to know who those people are. I want to find them, and I want to tell them that it's not that kind of show. Like, I sat down, I was working, like, night shifts, so I was, like, 8-hour night shifts doing pretty much nothing. And I just sat there and watched episode after episode of My Boys. And, you know, that's the kind of show this is. You're going to burn through it really quickly. There's a great dynamic in place, you know, that kind of reminds me of How I Met Your Mother, but it isn't thinking in the same terms. Like, it's not trying to be something big. It's not trying to be something complicated. And when it does try to be complicated, it falls apart. And thus far this season, I think it's very much within its wheelhouse. It knows what it's doing. The whole thing between PJ and Bobby has been really well handled so as to not disrupt the big dynamic. She's exactly. really smart stuff.
And it's provided some good moments. Like, one of my favorite moments in the show so far was in the previous episode, the boyfriend hat, with Andy trying to explain to him about the... that, you know, you used to be the friend or you were the colleague, but now you're the boyfriend. He goes, and he's like, the boyfriend hat? And he's like, well, it's really more of a helmet, but, you know. And
that's a great line.
You know, that goes on to tell it, and you're just like, it's just so well done. And then,
yeah, uh-huh.
And he says, just tells him to do that with, and then he's sitting there doing that, and it's like working, you know, and he's like, what?
The look on his face was great. Cal Newman nailed that. Well, this thing, like, and I really like when it kind of goes into that. And, like, and I still love that, you know, we talk about the wedding all we want. It's not really a huge deal. But I love that, like, that underlying secret of Kenny and Stephanie.
Yeah, which,
like, become this, like, huge, like, both characters are so overwhelmed by it. They still have their old dynamic, which has always been entertaining. And it feels like that's, like, a, you know, ace up their sleeve that they can throw when they need it. And that they're not rushing those kinds of things. Because what's always been the worst thing about My Boys is when they do rush into storylines, because it doesn't feel organic. The show operates at just a kind of a lackadaisical pace. Like, it's just, you know, people hanging out. When it becomes this, like, highly machinated, like, you know, point A to point B storylines, mm-hmm. it doesn't match. It doesn't work. And My Boys is a show that's all about those dynamics. And thus far this season, I've been impressed. So.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, the best part of it is, you know, like the beard growing contest or and all the joking around with each other that provides, you know, down the line. And and then the other thing, like, you know, or with her getting the column, and they were like, oh, the hot chick gets the column, of course, you know, and they had a lot of fun with that. But then you find out that really there was a hotter chick that was up for it, you know, that they didn't hire. Yeah. So, you know, it really was about your writing, you know. But it's that dynamic around when they're sitting around the poker table that creates some of the funniest lines and interesting dynamic between the two. I just wanted to say one thing about the last episode is when she was watching them at the memorabilia shop and he was watching TV, is I thought of you.
Oh, yes.
Because
they were watching curling.
Because they were watching curling on.
And I must admit, I love me some curling.
I do, too. I love me some curling.
It was
I find
funny.
It a fascinating sport based on strategy and skill that it's one of those sports where I don't play it, and I really wish I did, just so I could
use the wealth. Oh, me too. I've talked about creating a curling in Pennsylvania.
Well, it's like the wealth of knowledge that I feel like I've accrued by watching it, where I'm like, I know exactly what shots to play and all of that. I could never execute on any of it, but I know what to do. And that knowledge, I feel like I should be using it for some greater power. And, okay, that's me on curling, but I did find it great that was the sport they were watching, that was the most boring possible thing they could be doing in that scenario.
He's just sitting there going, sweep, 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 as he's watching the TV.
And he wasn't even really that, like, it wasn't like he was that involved in it, like, really obsessed with it. He was just kind of watching it absentmindedly.
Yeah, and she was like, this is what you guys do, you know. He's like, yeah, this is what we do.
I like the Bobby and PJ relationship. I do, and I think that since they started it in the beginning, they've kind of rushed in and out of it with PJ a lot, but I'm actually a Brendan and PJ fan.
Mm.
And I still kind of think that they should, that is my ship. I'm a PJ and Brendan shipper. And I really just feel like I wish they would get back to the close relationship that the two of them have.
Yeah. Like, Brendan's living in her apartment, but I don't know if they've actually shared a scene together all season.
Exactly. Like, just like when they made out in the kitchen that one time, I was so happy to see that. And then they quickly
pulled it away.
Okay. Now moving on to The Office.
Okay. So this is a situation kind of like what Shannon was talking about, how it has like ups and downs and and it changed itself kind of around a little bit by throwing this Michael Scott paper company at us. It could have gone so terribly wrong. It really,
so
really
terrible.
Could have. Yeah,
I went back and reread my review from, because the last review I wrote about the show before I went on my trip was the episode before they started the Michael Scott paper company, and he left at the end of it with Pam. And I pretty much was like, this is not going to go well. Like, this is going to be a disaster. Like, it just seems like felt like, you know, look on Pam's face, which is like, this is going to be awful. But then they had three episodes where in the building of storyline, there was some great comedy in there.
Oh, there really was. It's been laugh out loud funny. And like, but at the same time, incredibly poignant. We've gotten to see Pam really grow in 3 episodes. Like, she's now a salesperson.
It also provided the thing that I most like about the Michael character is why he's can be kind of a buffoon and not really get it in social situations, and he seems completely out of it. He does know what's going on in certain situations, and so for him to...
He was successful.
Yeah.
I never thought when that paper company started that he would get to the point where he did. And yes, as it was revealed, there was a lack of foresight involved. They didn't really pay enough attention to the logic of economics, but that doesn't really matter because the point was that Michael Scott knew what he needed to do to be successful, to gain clients. Like, in the episode between him and Dwight and that whole battle, like, Michael knew how to use the information he had and Dwight didn't. There's a difference between the two characters. And I think that the more the show, like, brought that to the surface, the more the arc didn't make sense because Michael was trying to prove a point. He felt like he had been attacked, like his work wasn't being appreciated, and exactly. While in those situations, I think it's somewhat justified that David Wallace would be somewhat annoyed with Michael, it is important to remember that he's good at what he does. He doesn't do it all the time, but when he does, he's really capable of it. And I thought it did a really good job of kind of cementing that, and I really do think that by the end of it, if you weren't rooting for Michael, I really don't know what's wrong with you.
And the pride Pam and Ryan had on their faces in the meeting in last night's episode, where Michael was actually saying what they needed and not letting on that they were broke and really sounding like a boss who knew, you know, I don't have to wait out Dunder Mifflin. I think I just need to wait out you. Like,
just so
the
good.
Pride
so
you good. Feel like you felt for Michael Scott. Like, it was so good.
Yeah, because they had just played that scene with Pam where she was like, oh my God, you know, like, I can't believe this. And then that she had followed Michael. And then the look on her face, like, when he says that to him, you know, turns it down and then, or tells them, you know, what they really need and then gets that offer of $60,000. And they're like, but then, you know, takes it one step further and even turns that down, you know.
Right.
And turns it in and gets his job back. And my favorite scene of it was the very end where the guy goes to say, like, goodbye. And Michael's like, no, you're gone. You're over. You know? And I was like, yes, I've been wanting that guy so over for a while now. It's like, thank you.
Yeah, like I think Charles Minor is a character. I mean, like, I love Idris Elba from The Wire. Like, love him to death. I think he's great. But the problem was it was always a transition character. And right. In a storyline like this, that it's one thing when, like, you take Michael Scott out of the position and put someone else in. And I think that if Michael had remained in the office, I think Charles could have become a really good foil for him. But the problem was that Michael kept being Michael. So really, the show wasn't that disrupted. Because it had to split its time between the two storylines, we really didn't get enough of Charles' dynamic with The Office to really let him develop into a really substantial guest star character. He was just kind of a fill-in that gave kind of Jim and Dwight some interesting background stuff. And they didn't have time to do more with it because Michael was still there in many ways an even larger capacity, having to start his own company.
It was so nice to see Jim, you know, back on top.
Oh, yes. Like, and for Charles to come to the realization that his decision to elevate Dwight above Jim was somewhat short-sighted. It's not
that was
just
so great. We should put bees. And he's like, what? He's just like looking at him like, what?
Why would he ever have a poor apiarist? Like, really? Yeah. Why would his standards be so low? Like, and like, those are the kind of things where, you know, I felt it really was like in an episode where the show really righted itself. I liked that Charles kind of started to come around to the reality of it, mm-hmm. where he started to see beyond, you know, the facade of all these things and start seeing kind of the real side of it in the same way that Wallace kind of had to do the same thing. And I love the moment where Wallace comes into the office and they're talking about it. And like Jim kind of says, you know, do you ever think that this wouldn't have happened if you had just taken his phone call? And, like, Wallace is, like, all the time.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that Michael was, you know, that his principles stand meant something. And that's what we were talking about Big Bang Theory earlier. I want it to mean something. When a character does something, I want it to have an impact. I want it to matter. And The Office is so good with doing that. And, yes, it's going to write itself. Yes, everything's, you know, but Pam's a salesperson now. Like, there's been changes that have taken place, dynamics that have altered. And while it definitely hasn't altered everything, it's not a game changer, that brief period of transition and disruption is going to make a huge difference towards moving towards the finale. And pretty much, I feel like it kind of rescued the show from a point where it was getting a little bit stale and really reinvigorated it.
Exactly. Exactly. 100%.
Okay. Now on to Parks and Rec.
Oh, God.
Which which I know it's just only three episodes in and it's trying to find its foothold, but for me, while I'm willing to give it a chance to try and find the balance between the characters and what each character is going to be and stuff like that, I still want it to be funny at some point in the process of doing that. And for me, it's
unrealistic
not.
Expectations.
I mean, what more do you want from a comedy but for, you know, it to be funny? But that's so far for me, there hasn't been enough in each episode that's been actually funny. You can right. see where the joke was trying to go or where something was trying to happen, but for me, the jokes just haven't landed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wrote 2,000 words about it today without really even trying. Like, I just kind of started writing, and it felt like a defense at the beginning. Like, it felt like I was really like, you know what? I want to give this show a chance. I like parts of it. I think Amy Poehler is great. I really like Paul Schneider. Rashida Jones is a good comic talent. And I thought this week's episode did some good stuff about making Mark have to be a bit more of an asshole, which I think is great. Like, I think it's important that he is not just as good as two shoes who's above Leslie, but that he's capable of kind of going down to her level in a way. And I'm like, all these things. But then at the end of the day, I look back and I'm like, the episodes themselves aren't that funny. And, right. you know, like, and I found it really interesting that I think I was reading Alan Sepinwall's review, and he's like, the only funny part of the third episode was that opening where she ate the plant and her tongue swelled up. And I'm like, it was funny, but it had no connection to the rest of the episode. Right. And as long as the show isn't going to be about that, it's not just going to be about Leslie going around and making an idiot of herself, but that it's actually going to be about this project, that's not how it's developing. But at the same time, I felt like the project is the only way we're getting any bits of character coming out. They're just coming out really, really slowly and not in particularly laugh-out-loud funny ways. And, you know, it's got a little 6-episode season here. It struggled on the ratings last night, but I think it wasn't too bad before that. So I really feel like, you know, The Office's little 6-episode season really didn't give a complete indication of what it could do in the future. I feel like judging Parks and Recreation at this point may be a bit premature, but at the same time, when it feels so much like The Office, you think it should be funnier than it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's the problem I've had is my remembrance of the first, you know, bit of episodes of, you know, the U.S. version of The Office was that there still was stuff that was funny. Is I remember still finding, you know, things that were funny while overall it may not have totally clicked. There was still something. It wasn't just potential. There was, like, potential plus. You know, you could see, you know, you were actually getting an example here and there of what the show could do. And so far, I'm not getting those examples of what it can do.
They actually did something with Aziz Ansari last night, and, like, I love him. I think he's hilarious. I love his tweets to the cast of Friday Night Lights and the cast of The Wire. Like, I think he's brilliant. But I just, the first episode, it was like, really? You're going to have this incredible comic talent and not do anything with him? But, like, watching him on the phone with, like, trying to get people, now that, to me, was funny. Like, that's something they should, he's this crazy guy who doesn't really know when to stop talking. And, they need to give him more to do and kind of less Amy Poehler, even though she's the star of the show. I don't know.
He's like a hustle. Like, you know, and like I thought, I even think it was interesting, you know, hearing this week, you know, his boss talking about how he's the perfect government employee because he doesn't do any work. He doesn't have any motivation. He doesn't want to do anything. He has no expectation, and therefore he doesn't need support. He doesn't need to be bossed around. He just kind of exists. Right. That's fine. And I think those kind of dynamics are really interesting. The problem is that right now, this project is so much about Poehler's character that you're kind of like, no other character is really going to get their big moment in the sun because they're just along for the ride. They don't care. Only Leslie cares. And I like that about the character. I find that her motivations are much more genuine than Michael Scott's ever were. That, you know, for most part, she's doing her job not because of some kind of, you know, self-satisfied need, but, you know, she's really kind of doing some good here. She just has no idea how to do it. But that isn't that funny. It's kind of got that side of Michael Scott that I like, which is more of the heartfelt kind of one. I enjoy that. It's something that I want this character to have. But it feels like they're going so far to develop that to make sure it's there that they're not letting her let loose comedy-wise. Like, you know, her falling down the pit was the closest we've really gotten to, you know, high embarrassment comedy on a broad level. And it wasn't that funny because it didn't feel like an organic part of the character. It felt like, look, she's funny because she fell down a pit. And I feel like at the same time, a lot of the other development of the characters, oh, look, she has a heart because she has a mom who put pressure on her. And because she can't deal well with the media and because she has this pre-existing relationship with Mark that gives her anxiety and she's jealous and that she's all these things, it seems like so much is going into humanizing her that it hasn't let her let loose yet. And that because it's focusing so much on that, it can't let the other characters let loose either. And you're just left at that holding pattern that can sustain my attention, but I don't think it can necessarily sustain itself into a second season. It would need that whatever break they get for retooling and everything is going to be – they're going to have to look – if they get a second season at all, they're going to have to look back on these episodes and say, okay, we've done this. We can stop doing that. And they need to make those kind of decisions to really bring the show to the level where I can consider it amongst Office and 30 Rock, et cetera.
Right.
But I'd like to say one thing is I would support Alan Sepinwall's idea of putting Chuck leading into The Office and 30 Rock on a Thursday night in the future. And if Parks and Rec had to go for that to happen, I would be more than happy to do so.
2 seconds. 2 seconds. Like, how quickly can I get the axe out? I'd be totally willing to do that. Like,
yeah, and having Zatari come on as a new Buy More clerk and having me Polar come in and guest star in an episode as like some crazy bad person, like, do that.
pretty much every other show on NBC's lineup, I'd be totally willing to just absolve into Chuck and just call it a day. Like, willing to do so.
The last show we have listed is 30 Rock.
Which I thought was hilarious last night.
I loved it last night, I must say. Like, you know, I really love The Office for its kind of heartwarming element, but I felt compelled to write about 30 Rock first, just because it was really funny, and I thought it was really playing the show's strengths.
Mm-hmm. When she yelled, "The Puerto Rican!" I was like, oh my God.
I loved it every time she came into the room.
Like, and Elisa's like, "Really, Liz?" Like, that it was, like... That it wasn't just that, like, it was a joke for us. Like, even within the show, they're like, that's a bit ridiculous. I also found it morbidly, the idea that you would make a joke about Kent State in any scenario. I'm just kind of like, I'm wrapping my head around it, just like, okay, they really did go there.
Yeah, I was like, did they just say that?
But the way the show goes about it, there's such a fast pace to it. And, you know, episodes like this, in terms of storyline, like, I never really got Elisa. Selma Hayek really didn't do anything for me in the role for the most part. There's a couple high points, but it just didn't really work. Whereas I thought in getting rid of her like they did, there was such a breakneck pace to it. Everything was moving so fast that it all worked.
Right.
And that nothing felt like it was dragging along. Like, even how they use Jenna in this episode, which is usually the linchpin of a bad episode of 30 Rock, is that Jenna is heavily featured and in the wrong fashion. I really liked how, you know, her storyline wasn't like she's a nuisance for someone. She's just crazy.
Yeah.
And that was important to me because it's not like Jenna dragging down somebody else. It's just Jenna dragging down her own self-respect. And that's perfect.
Yeah, I thought that it really provided the whole episode provided lots of great moments, like the opening with going in for the engagement ring. And the guy behind the counter thinking that Liz is who he's buying the ring for. And so he's showing, like, this limited selection. And then he finds out, he shows him a picture of Salma Hayek's character. And he's like, oh, well, let me take you to the room in the back where we have the real...
real showroom. And Liz getting her hand caught in the grate. Like, I mean, all that kind of stuff. Like, and I always love when Liz is playing Jack's bro.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
So Jack playing against type.
Jack opens the door and is like, but, you know, this is what I have to work with. You're the closest thing.
The closest thing to the man we have in this office. And the fact that that's actually true. And I always, like, I love when, you know, Elisa was questioning the relationship and Liz gives a little pose to show just how not graceful she is.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, the fact that Tina Fey can do that is pretty graceful. Like, she has such an ability to embody that element of the character. And I always find it so funny that Liz is often funniest when she's completely not – completely without any sort of feminine mystique, that she's just, like, straight down and dirty and going through that. But then when she's actually in relationships, that's – the character can take on that side of things just as easily.
Right.
Like, you know, she's going to win another Emmy, like, pretty much is guaranteed at this point, because I really don't – I think that the industry loves her too much, and there's been no downfall. Like, Liz hasn't fallen out of the spotlight. She's just as funny as she was before.
Right.
The whole thing with the gift for Tracy's wife, and then she says, why don't you just ask? And so they give, you know, her the gift of the jacket, and she's like, I take the slanket too if you give it to me. And then the rest of the episode, every time you see her, she's wearing it.
It's not product placement. I just like it. Which was a great callback to the whole McFlurry scandal.
Yeah, which was the one bit that the Elisa character in that whole scene with the McFlurries and stuff like that was great. I thought that was really was really funny.
McFlurries make everything fun. I must admit, that was one of the things traveling to the States that bothered me the most, is that you guys have M&M's. This is really off topic, I don't care.
We always go off topic, it's fine. We haven't gone off topic enough today.
I agree. You have M&M McFlurries, and we have Smarty McFlurries.
Now, see, I don't know what a Smarty is.
A Smarty is essentially an M&M, just with different chocolate inside, a brighter color palette. And I much prefer them to M&M's. We have M&M's too. So when the McFlurry was kind of ruined for me when I came to the States. So Canada 1, America 0 on the McFlurry side.
I love it. I've been trying to curtail my laughter. I swear.
I wonder why.
Anyway.
You've been trying to keep from filling time with your laugh.
Now then, so what's our topic for next week?
That's a good question. I don't know. Although at this rate, I could just break this one in half and put it over the next 2 weeks.
It's a long one, folks.
And that's what she said.
That's probably my fault.
No.
I tend to be a little long-winded.
I'm wordy.
2 weeks ago, it was just Amory and I. And we went like an hour and a half, just the two of us. And I had to cut it significantly back to get it to like an hour and 8 minutes or something like that.
Love it.
So I think that wraps up another episode here.
Yes. Thank our guests.
Yeah, it was great having you on, Miles.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was, of course, a lot of fun.
Excellent. Anytime one of us is unavailable, you're our next call.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it's good to actually speak to you instead of always either Twitter or in comments or something like that on in text form.
Yes, it's very much true. Yes, or randomly sitting directly behind Amory Ray at Philly Fest, which I swear was completely random.
It was so funny because, you know what, Shauna, I don't know if you guys follow Shauna at Tila J. Brown. Hey, Shauna. But she was sitting off to the side of us, too. And Ray and I didn't even realize it until later. I was like, Shauna, I think you're sitting near us. And she Twittered back. She's like, I thought I saw you. And then, I mean, later in the week, we caught up with her. But it was just so funny because it's so random how you guys ended up right behind us.
Yeah, and, like, I mean, like, I was at the Big Bang Theory panel, and, like, I was a little bit further back, and that time I'm like,
yeah, I think I saw Miles. I'm like, I don't know.
It was, but in that case, I was by myself and was just kind of like, okay, I'm just going to focus on taking pictures and do all that fun stuff. But
well, that was my favorite tweet, though, from back then, was when you did finally tweet about where you were sitting and who you were sitting with, and that it was like having your Twitter stream live and in person.
It was like Twitter had become real life, and I'm just like, this is fascinating. Because, like, I've never had that experience. Like, the amount of people I know on Twitter and I've actually kind of met up with is fairly limited. And I've had some of them kind of start bugging me about that because, like, I talk to them so much online and through the whole blog. Like, I never used to have that. But now it's like, oh, okay, you know, we should meet up sometime. And I'm like, that's going to be weird. Like, it just is. And but I must admit that, you know, Amory and Ray, you were both very good about it not being too weird. So that was very nice to see.
Excellent. I think that it's time to wrap because, as always, I got to eat.
Yes.
The way to end all podcasts. no matter what time of day it is. Intro and outro music, as always, was provided by IODA PromoNet, and it is the song TV Party by the Asylum Street Spankers off of their Mercurial title on Yellow Dog Records. Yes! Woo! I only had half of that written down, too.
All right.
Awesome.
If you want to leave us a message, go to the website, tvtimes3.com, spell it all out, or you can find us on twitter.com/tvtimes3, spell it all out. Leave us a message, send us an email. You can leave us a voice message on Snapvine. There's all kinds of ways to get in touch with us. More importantly, download our podcast on iTunes and leave us some feedback. And I think that's it.
We sit glued to the TV set all night.
And every night.
Why go into the outside world at all?
It's such a fright.
We got nothing better to do than watch TV and have a couple of brews.
I think that'll wrap up another episode.
That's a wrap of another long, long-ass episode.
So it is.